The Illinois House meets this afternoon to try and override Governor Rauner's veto and deliver the state's first budget in more than 2 years. Today, we hear your thoughts on the matter.
Well, I think Rauner's up to it. He's got his own agenda. Madigan's got his own agenda. That's what's put us in this bind. Neither one of them wanting to budge. Both of them want it their way. There's nothing we can do about it.
Is there nothing we can do about it? What do you think? Coming up first, we'll explain what lawmakers are voting on and what it means for you. Give us a call right now, 1-800-222-9455, or you can tweet to 21STShow. Plus, Sarah Lapido-Manyika's latest book tells the story of a 70-something-year-old Nigerian woman and the colorful life she leads.
I was finding so many interesting, flamboyant older women in real life, but I wasn't seeing them on the page.
We revisit our conversation with her coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're at day 736 without a state budget. Could today be the day it finally happens?
I'm very disappointed in our legislators. We elect them to office to do a job, and they're not doing their job if they can't pass a budget.
You can look at what the Republicans are doing as sort of like a punitive measure against what they see as administrative overspending. Anything you pay taxes for, they're trying to prove that it's not working, and because of that, we need to get rid of it.
I mean, I get the Republican stance on everything, but I kind of feel like, especially considering the financials of the state, I mean, higher taxes has got to be done.
If they're not doing their job, they shouldn't be there for 30, 40 years, you know, getting free money for doing nothing. That's the way I look at it.
Those are a few taxpayers our producer Christine Herman spoke with outside the Illinois Terminal in Champaign: Gary Walker, Timothy Sapp, Jeff Adams, and Jerry McCoy. On the 4th of July, the state Senate voted to override Governor Rauner's veto of the spending and tax hike proposals. Today, it's the House lawmakers' turn. They're scheduled to meet in about 2.5 hours. We're going to find out more about what to expect and talk about the threats some lawmakers are getting for their votes later in the show. But first, what's actually in these proposals? Beyond the $36 billion in spending and nearly $5 billion tax hike, the Civic Federation is a nonpartisan group that's advocated for a more conservative approach to state funding. President Lawrence Massal has been pushing for a state budget, very vocal about the damage done and how many decades it will take to repair. He's with me now in our studios at Northwestern's Middell School of Journalism in downtown Chicago to talk about the proposed budget, take your questions. Lawrence, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you.
As always, you're welcome to join our conversation. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. I see some of those Twitter comments coming in. We're going to get to that in a second. Lawrence, can I start with what's gotten the most headlines? The vote that would raise the personal income tax from 3.75% to 4.9%. In a statement that Governor Rauner posted on his Facebook page, he called it a 32% tax increase, the largest in state history. And he also had this to say yesterday.
And if we don't change, very soon, Illinois is going to have the highest overall tax burden of any state in America. We are on that path. And we've got to change direction.
That's some Facebook Live video from the governor yesterday. Lawrence, how accurate are the governor's statements about this being the largest tax increase in state history, a 32% increase?
Well, I think people will recall we had a temporary income tax increase that went from 3% to 5% on individuals in 2011. So that was really the largest. I think the governor is making the point, though, that Illinois needs to control its finances, needs to have fiscal discipline. The governor has proposed some changes in terms of the workers' comp system and some others that he believes will help grow the economy. Those are all things that could help grow the economy. But what is not helping the state of Illinois is not having a budget. The state's been without a budget now for over 2 years. Not having a budget is not the same thing as not spending money. Not having a budget and not raising taxes is not the same thing as not incurring liabilities beyond which you have the ability to pay. We have now over $14 billion in unpaid bills. We have been deficit spending at a magnitude of about $5 billion a year recently. So the state, which faces downgrade by the major rating agencies, needs to take action and have a budget.
All of those things we're going to talk about. We've also been asking you on social media what questions you have regarding the budget. Oh, by the way, we just got a tweet from Kurt saying, most citizens don't understand economics or math. This tax hike won't pay the bills. We're going to lose more people. and businesses. Nicole was just asking us on Facebook, Lawrence, if there's a tax hike, she says, I'd like to at least see a plan to cut spending and put the revenue to good use, digging the state out of its hole as much as possible. Do we know how the money from this proposed tax hike will be put to the use?
Well, clearly all of the money from this tax increase has already been spent.
We've already spent the money.
Right. So it's not a question of new programs or new expansions. The state has been in deficit spending. So what this is going to do is if the Illinois House today overrides the governor's veto, they will put in place the parameters for about $5 billion in new revenue to the state of Illinois. Almost all of that will go to pay obligations that have already been incurred, things like employee health care benefits for employees and retirees. We haven't been appropriating, yet we've been spending literally $1 billion a year without any means of paying. We pay enormous interest penalties of 12% a year on our health insurance bills.
And just to be clear, as people listen to that, that's actually current state employees, which we should add full disclosure. I am a state employee as being employed through the University of Illinois. That's, for example, if I have a health care bill, I'm paying my portion of the premium, but the state is not paying their portion.
The state is not even appropriated for your health care bills, and yet your providers, hospitals, doctors, medical people are providing services to the state employees and to the state. But the state, because it hasn't had a budget, hasn't had the discipline to say we're going to limit the amount of expenditure we have based on the available revenue.
Yeah, so that hasn't happened. Zakia wanted to know, what is Governor Rauner proposing we do in lieu of a tax hike? What's the alternative here if we're not going to raise taxes to solving our revenue?
You would have to dramatically cut about $6 to $8 billion out of the state budget. The state current revenues are about $31 billion. That would be an enormous restructuring. But then no one has proposed that. Even the people in the Springfield who have opposed this tax increase have not identified $6 billion that they could cut out of the state spending. In fact, because we've already spent it, because we've run up the unpaid bills by $14 billion, because we've let our credit rating drop to just one notch above non-investment grade or junk, we are really going to be using this money, hopefully, to stabilize the state's financial situation and avoid all the interest and penalty costs that we've been incurring.
I know you've just been looking. This is all happening very quickly. I know you've just had a chance, the Civic Federation. I know you guys are very thorough about what you do. You've had a chance probably to look at this language for 48 hours, maybe. What's your sense of, does this provide stability?
It basically, what this does is buy the state some more time. It does provide, as I said, $5 billion in new revenue to the state of Illinois, which will immediately go to some of the obligations the state is not meeting. Higher education, which is going to get a cut under this proposal. We haven't gotten the full rack up of exactly how much of a cut there is. It's been stated by the sponsors of the bill about 10%. But even that, for the employees who have not been getting their health insurance appropriated and funded, for the mental health services that have not been provided for the state, for all of the social service organizations that have been waiting for the state to pay its bills, and most importantly for elementary and secondary education, which is hoping that if this passes, there will be a restructuring of the school aid formula and money will begin to flow back into schools for not just their school aid formula, but the categoricals, transportation, special education, and reduced lunches.
Right. And those things are actually federal mandates that schools have also been footing the bill for, right? So those
Correct.
Are things schools are federally required to pay for. They've been paying for that themselves. Can I ask you a question about higher education? We spoke with a U of I student, Gary Walker, this morning. Lawrence, he's a recipient of a MAP grant. That's the monetary award program for Illinois residents with financial need. It doesn't need to be repaid. He's concerned about what happens if the state doesn't pass a budget.
U of I basically gave me a MAP grant and said, if we don't get the state to refund us this, then you'll have to pay another $6,000. And it's like, I'm on Medicare and Medicaid trying to make my life better. And how am I going to come up with another $6,000? The way I understand it is if we get a budget pass, I'm assuming everything is fine.
Is everything fine for MAP grant students like Gary under this proposed budget?
Well, under this proposed budget, it appears that things will be better for Gary in the sense that they fully fund the MAP grant program. But the details of how that is going to be accomplished going forward remains a question. The state is not out of the financial woods simply by doing what 49 other states do every year, which is pass a budget and live according to their revenue and expenditures. We've dug the hole so deep that the impact on the U of I goes beyond just the MAP grant. It basically the corrosive nature of not knowing if your state is going to support its higher education interest in its students. People are making decisions based on that uncertainty, and that is never a good situation.
What does this budget look like in terms of funding higher education? Do we have a sense of that?
The numbers that we have heard, and we have not had the time to fully verify them, is there is about a 10% across the board cut for higher education. That's according to President Cullerton in a recent statement today.
10% compared to last year or compared to previous years?
Because it appears that it is the last again, and that's an excellent question.
Which was another cut also, right? So
not getting cut is not the same thing as getting funded as well, right? Because if you don't, if they appropriate as they do for elementary and secondary education, but there's not enough money to pass the categoricals down to the local school districts, it's meaningless to them. They have to wait for the money. In this case, it looks like a significant cut, but it adds predictability. If, in fact, it is a 10% cut to higher education, the universities and colleges can plan accordingly, and they can begin to make the adjustments that they need in the beginning of the year. That's the big difference. Having a budget when you start the year makes it that much more manageable. If you wait until halfway through the year is over, as we've done in previous years, or if we don't ever have a budget, that's the worst possible scenario.
And is this retroactive then, what we're thinking in terms of what's going to be passed now? What about the first 6 months of the year?
No, this will be what it appears, at least on the revenue side, it will be beginning July 1st.
So The revenue will be, but what about spending?
We have not received sufficient detail to understand how this affects the second half of last year and how that will be going forward.
Oh, right. Okay. So there's a lot of questions.
So this is the
here.
Beginning of a brand new fiscal year, and it's a budget based on the next fiscal year. We have not gotten the full verification for how the higher ed fares over the last 6 months.
Or social service agencies for the last 6 months,
exactly.
All of those bills.
Well, in the case of most of the social services, with the exception of mental health and those that are not covered by federal decree, it's likely that this will certainly not only appropriate enough for them, but it will also provide some pay down of the unpaid bills, which many social service providers have been waiting 6 months, a year or more to be paid.
I'm speaking with Lawrence Massal. He's president of the Civic Federation. We're taking your tweets, your questions on Facebook about what this means. Lawrence, you know, clearly what it sounds like what you're saying is, and it sounds like you've said this a couple times, in other words, if they pass a budget, this is by no means the end of the story. There's lots of questions here. And that leads me to the ratings agency. So as you mentioned, we're teetering on the brink of junk status. We're already the worst in the country. Yesterday, Moody said, even if we pass a budget, we might still be downgraded to junk. I suspect you would say that's because of everything you've just said, because this is a step forward, but we're still pretty far behind.
The role of the rating agencies is to protect or give an assessment of what the likelihood of the state is to pay back its money that it borrows in the markets. It's a credit rating. And Illinois has proven itself to be very uncreditworthy in the terms of following the practices, such as having a balanced budget each year, having a plan for dealing with your liabilities. The state generally has always prioritized debt and the repayment of its debt. But saying that you're going to pay something off and showing that you have the means to pay something off are different things. The rating agencies are saying Illinois has great financial challenges. This tax increase that has been proposed or that has been passed by the General Assembly and is apparently going to be voted for override later today is not going to be a panacea for the state. It is going to be at best a platform to move forward. There are still big challenges even with this. The $5 billion of new revenue that this provides dwarfs the $14 billion in unpaid bills that the state has racked up over the last year. It dwarfs the $120 billion unfunded liability. But it gives the state a basis to work on those things to go forward.
Lawrence, do you think this gives the state the basis to work on things going forward, given the fact that if this passes, it passes without the governor's support?
Well, the governor is clearly integral to the implementation of the budget, and he will follow the state law, whatever the state law is. It is not ideal that, and that's what the rating agencies are saying in their commentary, that it doesn't appear that there is consensus on the plan going forward. But they're saying, but two of the other rating agencies are also saying, all three are saying, if you don't have a budget, if they've given us beyond July 1st, which was the beginning of the fiscal year, you face certain downgrade into non-investment. And what's important for everyone to know is that there's no history of states going into junk bond status. The reason why is because it's enormously expensive. There's no history in terms of 49 other states going more than a couple of months without a budget. The reason why is because it's enormously expensive. This grand experiment in Illinois to try to operate without a budget for now for 2 years has proven that it's enormously expensive, and we have all the evidence we need to know that it's not sustainable. We need a budget just so that you can begin to work on the other longer-term issues. Without a budget, you're not managing the financial condition of the state.
The big question, Lawrence, the Constitution requires that this budget be balanced. Do we know that this budget is balanced?
So the state constitution requires that the governor propose a balanced budget, and the state constitution requires the General Assembly to pass a balanced budget. There is not a requirement that the state of Illinois enact a balanced budget. There's not even a requirement that the state of Illinois publish an enacted budget so that people can identify whether it is fully balanced or not. However, this $5 billion in new revenue that the state is enacting is something that will be used to come closer. And basically on the very initial reading, appears that the state has matched its projected spending next year to its available revenue if this tax increase is overridden in the House and it becomes law.
Can I ask you for your prediction? Do you think this will be overridden this afternoon?
It appears that there is a recognition. The Illinois House, even more so than the Illinois Senate when they did their grand bargain, the Illinois House was able to draw Republican support for the tax increase and send it to the governor the first time. We're being told that it's close, but they appear from some of the people in Springfield that there is a recognition that if they don't override the governor's veto, Illinois' downgrade to junk bond is certain. The cost to the state will be enormous.
That's the Civic Federation's Lawrence Missal. Coming up at the end of the hour, we're going to go back to this topic, continue to take your questions. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, generating new knowledge and developing and evaluating new technologies and methodologies to better distribute scholarly knowledge. The University Library at Illinois.
This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Sarah Ladipo-Manyika is a novelist and essayist who stands at the intersection of different cultures. She was raised in Nigeria and has lived in Kenya, England, and France, and currently is in San Francisco, where she teaches literature at San Francisco State University. Her latest work is a novella called Like a Mule, Bringing Ice Cream to the Sun. Its main character is a woman of a certain age and the very colorful life she leads, or at least is trying to. Sarah, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much. Hi.
Hi. The main character of this story is a 70-something-year-old woman. Her name is Dr. Mariah Da Silva. She's a very healthy, independent, active Nigerian woman living in San Francisco. I love that she wears hot pink bras. you've said in the past you've met many older women who've lived colorful lives, but there aren't many fictional stories about them, especially if they're Black women. And I wonder, right, was the character of Dr. Da Silva inspired by any women in particular that you've met?
Her character was inspired by many women, and I think in a way that was part of the point, that I was finding so many interesting, flamboyant older women in real life, but I wasn't seeing them on the page. I always paraphrase Toni Morrison when she says, if there are stories that you want to read but you can't find them, then you must write them. So my main character is not after one particular person, but she was certainly inspired by many people.
I've never read a book about an aging lady that includes a frank discussion of her sexuality. Why was that an important part of this story?
Well, I think, again, I had read many stories about older men, great writers like Philip Roth and Ian McEwan and so forth, who have written about older characters who are very sensual and so forth, men, but not women. And in real life, my experience was that, you know, older women could be just as sensual, just as playful, and but these were just stories that I wasn't finding on the page. And so to have an older Nigerian woman who is living in a hip, young, technology-savvy San Francisco and who is vibrant and flamboyant, as you said, you know, she'll go out for early morning walks and she'll talk to her eclectic group of friends, also characters that perhaps people haven't seen in literature, so shopkeepers, there's a homeless woman who's a friend of hers, and, you know, she has this very poised, proper English accent, Nigerian, with touches of a Nigerian accent there as well. And she'll talk about her life and this, you know, very colorful life that she's led prior to coming to San Francisco. She was an ambassador's wife. And so when she talks about going to Buckingham Palace or meeting Mrs. Gandhi, these are not exaggerations. And she also, you know, she goes for her walks, but she also loves to drive. And she has a very fancy sports car that she spent a lot of money on. And all of this, I think, just underscores her fiercely independent streak and her desire to live life to the fullest, which, of course, is threatened when she has a fall. But it doesn't stop her from being this larger-than-life character, and these characters exist in real life.
And Sarah, that scenario, I'll be honest with you, I feel like every time I go into a retirement community, I think about the scenario that Mariah's in, where she falls and she ends up in this home where people are so much worse off than she is, particularly mentally. And I kind of feel like that's probably everyone's worst nightmare of aging. Is that something you've thought a lot about?
It is, absolutely. And, you know, one of my older friends who was a source of inspiration for this particular book was someone who was in her late 80s and had Parkinson's disease and then Parkinson's related dementia. And, you know, of course, that's really difficult, really awful, and, you know, a personal fear of mine. And I think in a sense, I was writing this story, sort of rewriting the end of her life, as it were, with a more upbeat note, particularly addressing that. Yes. It's old age, you know, as my character says, quoting Philip Roth, can be a massacre.
And so there's a lovely scene when she's in the dining hall where she transports herself in her head. It was a fascinating thing for me to read because on the one hand, there's the reality of the situation where she gets dressed to go to dinner and realizes that none of her lovely clothes are with her because the bag that they packed that someone grabbed to take with her to this place was not really meant for traveling. And so then she sort of just decides in her head she's going to put on another outfit. And then So there's this juxtaposition of the reality that she's in. And did you mean that scene to sort of just be like a daydream for her?
You know, she doesn't see it as a daydream. She's just living as she has led. And if I recall that scene, she's playing some music in her head. She likes to get dressed up, always has. And so she just continues that. And, you know, I think, you know, going back to something you were saying earlier, when I started to write the story, I thought I wanted to make my character 80. And people that I discussed it with said, oh, no, you can't do that. You know, she's too flamboyant and too sensuous for a woman at 80.
For an 80-year-old, too sensuous.
The funny thing is, as soon as I finished writing the book, and this was just a few months ago, I met a woman who, just looking at her, I thought she was the age of my main character. And we started to talk, and she mentioned going back to college or going back to an old college for a 75th reunion. And I thought I'd misheard her. But then I said, how old are you? And she said, I'm 96 going on 97.
Oh, my.
And she is just, I mean, she's obviously an outlier, and so she's very fit and she walks and she swims, or she's been trying to swim all her life. She still doesn't know how to swim, but she continues to take swimming lessons. But she just has this great spirit. And, you know, I said to her, I'd love to write your story, your real story. And she said, oh, honey, I have too many secrets. you know, including the fact that she has a man friend who doesn't know how old she is. So, you know, this sort of playfulness, great, the sensuality and so forth, that was really exciting for me to see, you know, here she is making my main character look like a baby. So.
And I wonder how much to her flamboyance, her energy, how much of that you think is cultural? Because I'm interested in sort of the juxtaposition of what we have in this country, sort of an American notion of aging versus maybe, you know, her, Dr. Da Silva Mariah's perspective as a Nigerian woman who's lived all over the world and in San Francisco. I even wonder if it's different perhaps in cities than it is in the U.S. compared to rural areas, sort of a concept of what aging is.
Yeah, I think for her it's both cultural and it's also a personality thing for her. I think she comes from Nigeria, so she's grown up in a culture that has for a long time, as with all cultures around the world, held old age up with some, seen older people as being wise, as a certain amount of reverence for old age. And so I think this is one of the things I was really interested in exploring, because she's now living in a society that's quite young, or that certainly values youth over age. And how does she negotiate that? And how does she, you know, hold on to what she has grown up with? And, you know, this has a personal relevance for me. I look at my father, who just turned 80, and he, you know, every decade, new decade that he turns, he's so excited. You know, he's excited about getting, he lives in London, so excited about getting his free bus pass when he was, I don't know, 60 or 70. And, you know, it's a celebration, and definitely coming from a culture that celebrates each new milestone and doesn't have the same fear. You know, again, I don't want to idealize cultures or say that cultures remain static or that everyone thinks the same, but certainly there is a difference between how older people are treated and perceived in other cultures in comparison, I think, to the way that you'll find it in many parts of America.
Sarah, you were actually shortlisted for the Goldsmith Prize last year for this novella.
I'm not sure about this, actually, but I think it was the first time that at least an African woman, I'm not sure if it was a black woman, but an African woman had been shortlisted for the prize.
Congratulations.
But it was, thank you, but it was, but much more than that, it was an exciting prize for me to be shortlisted for, because I had been a bit bolder with this, experimenting in terms of the length. Often people say don't write novellas because they don't sell. Experimenting in terms of content, writing about a character that's not featured, as we've discussed, a black woman, older black woman, and writing in multiple first persons. So it was really fun to be shortlisted for that prize and be amongst some many writers that I've admired.
Well, and as you say that, I can't help but think of one relationship in the book between this gentleman named Reggie, whose wife is at the home with advanced stages of dementia, and Mariah. How did that relationship come about? Did you intend that relationship would end up in the book, or did that just happen as you started writing?
That was a case of something surprising me when I put my character in that situation and began to imagine who she might meet and what sort of characters she might meet. I did have a student a few years ago who had a partner who was sick and just beginning to have the first signs of dementia. And I remember talking to her about her decision. I think she was about 80 at the time, her decision not to move into a home with her partner. And I just remembered how difficult it is for any partner who has another partner who's beginning to show signs of dementia. But, you know, what does that mean for the relationship? What does that mean for love and so forth? So I think that was probably in the back of my mind as I began to think about the character of Reggie.
And then she also has this lovely relationship with this younger Indian woman named Sunshine. How did you imagine they met?
Yes. Well, I imagined her, meeting this woman in the apartment where she lived, and I imagined this woman, as you said, she's of Indian heritage, so she's familiar with different cultural approaches to aging. And I just imagined the two of them would strike up a friendship, that they would be, each would have something that they would bring to the other. And without giving away too much of the plot, one of the younger woman trying to be of help to Mariah when she has a fall and is taken to a recuperation home, it actually doesn't help her. So there I was also exploring misunderstandings, and we think we're helping people, but we might not be helping people by organizing their lives in ways that the particular person doesn't want. So, yeah.
Speaking of organization, I love the idea of arranging books. This happens in the novella, not by alphabet or by the color of their spine, but by the idea of which characters should be talking to each
right.
other. Do you do that?
Yeah. I have to admit, I do that. I will finish a story and I'll think, oh, I would have ended it in a different way, or I wonder what would have happened if such and such a thing had happened. And I'll often look at my books on the shelves and I will imagine what kind of conversations the characters in the books have with each other. So, yes, that is quite an autobiographical element of the book.
There's also, speaking of books, a great list you have of authors that Mariah provides for a chef at the home, where she kind of comes up with a reading list for him, this young African-American, where she includes not just sort of kind of like the canon you'd think of, right? Like James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison, but C.L.R. James. I wonder what would be in your essential book list for young Black people in this country.
Well, just off the top of my head, Toni Morrison, for sure. I love the way that she writes for the ear, and I love the way that she has she's written the American story from a perspective that it was never really written before her. I think she's just been very groundbreaking in that sense. So definitely Toni Morrison. I would recommend all sorts of writers. Mohsen Hamid is one writer that I've enjoyed reading recently. I love the length of his books. They are sort of novella length, I love the idea of reading a book in a day or so, which is something that I try to do with my book, the latest book. Yemisi Arabisala is a really exciting new writer. She's written a book entitled Soup, Sex, and Nigerian Taste Buds. And Long Throat Memoirs, Soup, Sex, and Nigerian Taste Buds. I would definitely say Baldwin, though.
Sure.
Baldwin is a go-to all the time.
Mm-hmm. Last question for you, Sarah. I wonder what you think, as I was reading this, one of the things that the producers and I were talking about was what you think might be missing in terms of portrayals of Black women, specifically African women, whether we're talking about British or American writing about them.
In terms of I think there are so many stories, and for me, this excites me. There are so many stories that haven't been told about whether it's African American women or it's African women living in different parts of America, living in different parts of the world. Women from different socioeconomic backgrounds, different sexualities, different ages. I mean, so I see it, at least for a writer, as something really exciting, that there is so much to write. I mean, one often hears people saying, every story has been written, but I disagree with that. I think all themes and ideas, people have always written about love and death and struggle and depression and so forth, but the actual characters, where people come from and, from different cultures and different ethnicities and so forth, those stories haven't all been written.
Sarah Laripo Manica's latest novella is called Like a Mule Bringing Ice Cream to the Sun. Sarah, thanks for being with me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. So much fun.
coming up, we continue our conversation about the big budget vote this afternoon with the Illinois Manufacturers Association, and we'll keep taking your questions. Tweet us at 21STShow. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. We could be hours away from the end of the state budget impasse that's been going on for more than 2 years. The Illinois House of Representatives will try to override Governor Rauner's veto and push through a $36 billion spending bill and tax hike proposal. The House is scheduled to begin its session at 1:30 this afternoon. The vote will be tight. The House needs 71 votes to override the veto. The bill passed the first time with 72 votes, including 15 Republicans. Last night, Governor Rauner urged legislators not to override his veto. House Republican leader Jim Durkin said he and Governor Rauner still believe, quote, there is a better deal to be had, Reuters reports. Representative Durkin said that some Republicans may face challenges in the 2018 election based on how they vote today. Stay tuned to this public radio station for more on the vote this afternoon. We'll be updating you, especially during All Things Considered. First, we're joined now by Mark Densler. He's Vice President and Chief Operating Officer for the Illinois Manufacturers Association, here to give us the perspective from the association's 4,000 manufacturing companies and plants that are members from Illinois. Mark, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hey, good morning, Nyla. Thank you for having me. It's a beautiful day in Springfield.
Good. It's a beautiful day in Springfield, Mark. What does the Illinois Manufacturers Association want to have happen with the vote that the House is holding this afternoon?
Well, you know, the state of Illinois certainly needs a budget. There's absolutely no doubt about it. We need the predictability and we need the stability the state budget brings. However, we also need the economic development reforms that are missing from this package. Our members are angry, they're frustrated, they're disappointed that the General Assembly has not enacted or passed any of these measures that are going to help create jobs in the state of Illinois. And I think in their view, simply raising taxes by $5 billion without reforming the way we spend the money or making Illinois more attractive for job creators is not the right answer. And so we hope that lawmakers will continue working on important things like property tax relief, reducing the high cost of pensions, which Moody's cited when they talked that we still may go to junk bond status, and things like workers' compensation reform. We're the eighth highest cost state in the country, and so we don't think the job is done. There's no doubt we need a balanced budget, but we also have to have the economic development reforms.
So that said, if we need a balanced budget, do you support, does the Illinois Manufacturers Association support overriding Governor Rauner's veto?
You know, we opposed the package when it was put forward because it wasn't a package. Again, it only dealt with one leg, which was the tax revenue and the budget. It did not deal with the economic development reform part of it. So, we don't think the job is done. Certainly, a lot of lawmakers on both sides of the aisle spend a long time working to try to get some kind of compromise. The IMA was engaged for months. I remember getting called in the office on Super Bowl Sunday to talk to the Senate president and his staff. And so we've been engaged for many months to try to find a solution. We think a solution at the end of the day probably is going to entail additional revenue and budget cuts, which both of those are contained, but it has to have these economic development reforms as well.
And do you feel confident that lawmakers will take up these economic issues, in particular overhauling workers' comp?
You know, unfortunately, I don't feel confident. They did not do it during the regular session or the special session. Unfortunately, Democrats protected the interests of trial lawyers and labor unions and medical community as opposed to trying to make these systems more fair. And you know, we asked the question with manufacturing employing about 570,000 workers, you know, why are legislators continuing to protect the interests of the wealthy trial lawyers and the labor unions as opposed to the job creators? And You know, there are things that can be done that will protect the rights of injured workers, for example, not reduce their benefits, but reduce costs in the system. And we think those types of things need to happen. But again, they didn't do it during the session, so I'm not sure I have a whole lot of hope that they're gonna do it moving forward.
Mark, you mentioned your members, and I know when you talk to business owners, one of the big issues they are always concerned about is education. It's always an important thing for recruiting and retaining workers to have a good public education system. What are your members saying right now about funding through K-12 education?
You know, there's certainly education and workforce development is critical. The IMA has a middle-class manufacturing agenda, and one of those is strengthening the workforce and education system. And it starts in the K-12, and it goes up to community college and higher education. Not every student's prepared to go on to a four-year school. So we have to have that pipeline of qualified workers. As an example, Nyla, as I said, we have about 570,000 workers in the manufacturing sector today. Half of them are going to retire in the next 10 years or so. So just to remain level with what we have now, we need about 25,000 production workers and 5,000 engineers every single year. They face major challenges trying to get those workers in the pipeline. So our schools have to do a better job of educating kids. We have to really work on the math and science. And then when the kids come out or you have returning veterans or dislocated workers, we have to have the system in place so they can find these good high-paying jobs.
Sure. And I think all of that is certainly something when you talk to superintendents in schools, those are things that are important. But I can't help but think of a superintendent who was on the 21st earlier this week saying he didn't know if he had enough money for textbooks for the fall. And when you talk to other superintendents who say they don't know if they can make payroll and open in time, how important, crucial do you think is funding for bills like SB1, other funding for K-12 right now?
Well, certainly we want schools to open on time. I mean, nobody wants them to remain closed. I think there's two competing proposals out there that my understanding they're very similar. And so I think that the General Assembly will iron out those details. Certainly, as you're aware, the budget that passed contains a provision in there that money for general state aid cannot be distributed unless you have an evidence-based system. So when the Democrats inserted that, they kind of set themselves up for additional negotiations. So I think that's something that will be worked out over the next several weeks, and I'm optimistic that schools will open on time and they'll have additional resources. That's been a commitment from the governor and from all lawmakers.
On the line from Springfield, Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Illinois Manufacturers Association, Mark Densler. Mark, I appreciate you taking the time. Thanks for being with us.
No problem. Thank you now. Have a great day.
As we said earlier, we're about an hour and a half from what we expect will be a House vote. That's scheduled for 1:30. I'm joined now by Natasha Karecki, who writes the Illinois Playbook for Politico. Natasha, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
Natasha, you just heard the perspective from Illinois manufacturers about the budget, saying that they need stability. They want their manufacturers want that, but still sort of talking about the issues that were Governor Rauner has said are most important to him, workers' comp. I just want to ask, first of all, though, let's just get to first the nitty gritty of for the last 2 days, there haven't been enough lawmakers to do any House business. Today, of course, we have the big vote scheduled for this afternoon. What's your sense of how things are looking right now?
I think Mike Madigan wouldn't have set the session vote, the override vote today, if he didn't think that he'd have certainly a quorum and if not the override numbers. And from all other accounts, it appears they'll have the numbers. And as we reported today, one of the GOP crossover yes votes is actually gone on a trip. I hear someone else might also be absent today, but others might make up for those missing votes. So, of course, you need 71 votes, which means Republicans need to who crossed over before would need to do the same today. And from all accounts, I think that's still where we're headed.
Right, 72, and I guess because of that 72. What the bill passed the first time with, there were a couple of Democrats who didn't vote, right, Natasha, because it's sort of because of the 15 that had crossed over. Am I correct on that? So is that where we think the difference will make up?
Yes, that. And there's even a possibility that another Republican might cross over. others have reported, even though Governor Rauner, you know, said yesterday that he was doing everything he could to stop this, there's quite a few lawmakers who said, we haven't even heard from the governor. I said I was going to vote for it before. I didn't hear from him. I said I'm going to vote for it again. Also didn't hear from him. These are Republicans. You know, so it's very interesting what's happening right now. I mean, I think there's some thinking that Rauner believes this will be good for him politically. It'll give him a budget finally, but he doesn't feel he'll have to own it because he vetoed it. Others will have to own it. And it's a tax increase, and he can harp on that, and that would be enough perhaps to mount a campaign around.
As we talk about that, there has been backlash. You wrote a story yesterday about Republican lawmakers, I'm thinking in particular of floor leaders who voted for the tax hike, getting at least one report of a death threat, lots of anger towards Republicans, certainly also some Democratic lawmakers also facing lots of some nasty comments on social media. Natasha, what's going on? What's happening here?
It is, on one level, it's the state of our discourse, in the United States, and we're seeing it here in Illinois. People see tax increase. They have a general distrust toward politicians and an even more specific distrust toward Springfield politicians, and they just unleash this wrath. But some of them really go overboard. One legislator was called a leaping animal.
Leticia Wallace was called that, right? Yeah. She's a Rockford area representative. Another word we can't say on the radio, she was also called,
And hanging, and said it should be hanging from a tree. Anderson, a GOP House floor leader, he said he got the nastiest stuff. He couldn't even repeat it, but one specific thing, I'm coming for you, and that's what caused him to report it to the Illinois State Police, who are now investigating that. And yesterday, so many Republicans were reporting that they got threatening communications, some of them borderline, some of them, you're not sure. And so a memo actually went out from the House Republicans saying, here's what to do in this instant. Here's, who to call. Here's how to handle it. Here's how to protect yourself and your family. So it's a very serious situation. And after I posted that story, the Illinois Policy Institute grabbed the story we wrote about, some of this backlash and posted it on their website and said, look, everybody tone it down. Please don't use foul language. Threats don't help our cause. And then if you look under there.
So the Illinois Policy Institute, Natasha, you should explain to our listeners, conservative funded.
Right. They are dark money funded, think tank. They are very against taxes. They are anti-tax. They say they represent the taxpayer. They've really gone after some of these lawmakers really hard. Please contact them, very specifically. We have sources, for instance, they'll say that they have sources saying a couple of Republicans were going to vote for the budget and posted their names and office numbers.
Yesterday they did repost your story and they said, let's be respectful. And what were some of the comments after that, Natasha?
So some of the comments were kind of unbelievable. I mean, they were even, why should we be respectful? They're not respectful toward us. And then say things like, it's time to get water from the tree, which is an expression for really, with blood, taking the time to water the tree of liberty. It's an old expression. And someone said, with blood, and said, yes, that was implied. The kind of discourse that's going on is very serious, and I think anyone who stokes that is really playing with fire right now. People are just angry. And I think part of it is all this money that's been spent influencing the Illinois public on, Mike Madigan, sort of demonizing him, obviously Madigan and Pritzker and others have funded their own sets of commercials that have run that aren't positive toward the governor. So
Yeah, so lots of anger, lots of on both sides. Natasha, you know, we just have about a minute left. Let me ask you one last question. If this passes, the Democratic-controlled State House will have passed a budget without enacting Governor Rauner's economic agenda. It's been more than 2 years since we've had a budget. Why couldn't Democrats have done this 2 years ago, back when they had a supermajority?
Well, they could have done it, to answer your question. They certainly could have done it. They didn't, because the governor said, hey, I was elected. I have a mandate. Please do not reinstitute this temporary tax increase. I'm going to figure out a way out of this. And so they got together and they tried working it out. It's been 2 years. It's just gotten worse. And it's gotten to the point where Republicans, who are typically pretty conservative, have crossed over and said, enough. Our districts can't handle this anymore. We're killing our districts. So they've crossed over. And
we'll see this afternoon if that continues to happen. I want to thank Politico's Natasha Karecki. You can sign up for her Illinois Playbook. We'll tweet out links to that. Natasha, thanks for being with us. Always great to have you on, some of your analysis.
Thanks for having me.
We want to know how you feel about what happens this afternoon. We're going to talk about it tomorrow. You can call our hotline at 217-300-2121 and leave us a voicemail. Maybe we'll play it tomorrow on the program. Comptroller Susana Mendoza, former Governor Jim Edgar, and others will join us for reaction. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st, a production of Illinois Public Media.